starting with the overall book itself, if we can, the Happy Alone Home Loan Home book, can you just talk to us about what's inspired it? How did you come up with the title?
People often think when I speak to them, oh, just get investment debt because owner-occupied debt is bad debt. I'm like, it's the best debt you could ever have. If you need somewhere to live, you've got to rent or you've got to buy your own home. And I really just want to flip it on its head, going, rent isn't dead money. Investment debt isn't necessarily good money or good debt.
Welcome to Get Invested on the Property Hub podcast channel, the leading weekly show to help you unlock your full self, health, and wealth potential. I'm your host, Bushy Martin, and each week I go deep with the best investors, experts, leaders, and founders to find out what it takes to break free from the grind, discover freedom, and live by design. Subscribe now and join me and get invested in the life you really want. Let's get started.
Hi, Freedom Fighters. Do you own your own home? Do you want to? And do you want to help your kids to actually buy a home? The Australian dream of home ownership is actually deeply embedded in our culture, and I can see why. The sense of security and peace of mind that comes from owning your own home can't be underestimated, and it's really hard to put into words. Having your own piece of paradise is absolutely worth striving for and working hard for. Our own place to call home and haven amid growing uncertainty in the constantly and rapidly changing world is not only important to our underlying feeling of well-being and achievement, but 54% of Australians' personal wealth is tied to the value of our homes. Our homes make up a big portion of our personal expression, our family memories, our social connections, and our personal pride. But if you make the mistake of starting to believe everything that we constantly hear in the mainstream media as we drown ourselves in a never-ending stream of negative noise, you'd be led to believe that the Australian dream is dead and that owning a home is now out of the reach of most of the age-old housing affordability debate, which continues to rage. Because what we hear about and think about is subconsciously what we actually bring about. But where there's a will, there's always a way. So if home ownership is still something that's important to you, your children, your family, and your loved ones, then you're going to really enjoy renewed hope and motivation to keep your Australian dream alive from today's returning guest, Aaron Christie David. He's recently released his great book, The Happy Home Loan Handbook. It gives you all of the good oil on how to overcome the hurdles and challenges that get your home loan approved, how to buy your dream home, and, as importantly, how to keep enjoying your life. Last week, Aaron shared his inspiring journey from humble beginnings to become the director of Atelier Wealth, which is a family-driven award-winning mortgage brokerage that's actually enabled over 1,000 hardworking Aussie families to confidently buy their home or investment property. Now, as you enjoyed last week, Aaron and I actually have a lot in common. We both followed similar pathways, and we actually share many experiences and networks. We're both mortgage brokers. We both enjoy Dent's life-changing Key Person of Influence program. We both host podcasts. So if you haven't already, have a listen to the Australian Property Investment Podcast that Aaron very diligently provides some fantastic information and guests on. And most importantly, we both care about helping you and other hardworking Aussies to achieve your property and your life goals. So I'm really looking forward to unpacking the Happy Loan Handbook. So welcome, and let's get invested again, Aaron.
Thank you very much, Bushy. Appreciate it.
Mate, very privileged to have received a copy of your book. It was a really good read. I like the sort of conversational way that you take us on the journey. But before I sort of break into that, then pretty much to set the scene, what are some of the biggest problems and mistakes that you see people making around borrowing money for a home or property investment?
Break it up. So the biggest mistake is waiting, and then the biggest mistake around borrowing is fearing and putting the energy into the loan and not the property. So they worry more about, am I getting my loan approved, than spend that energy into finding the right home. I feel like they compromise the asset because they put a lot of energy into the loan approval. I think that probably comes a lot out of fear. We spoke a lot about fear in our previous episode. Am I going to get the loan? Will the bank approve my loan? And I'm like, don't worry about the loan. The loan's the easy part. It's finding the right home. That's the hard part. And I think that's what the home buying journey over years has shown and taught me as well.
Well, I'm going to circle back onto that home loan journey, the difference between mistakes that people make around that versus what you're going to recommend, because you really spell it out extremely well in the book. But sort of starting with the overall book itself, if we can, the Happy Alone Home Loan Handbook, can you just talk to us about what's inspired it? How did you come up with the title? Why did you write it? What are the key messages, and who's it best suited for? So that I've captured a lot in there. So let's start with what actually inspired the book initially.
Yeah, look, it's been, like you said, we did PPI, the KPS Influence course. I think that kind of plants the seed in there that if you have a really good message, why can't you share it with more people? And the book in its current form is years of conversations that have come out, been fine-tuned with people, what's resonated with some people more than others, for example. So when you look at it, it's a collection of conversations that have been rewrapped up into a book format is how I look at it. So it's tried and tested in the sense that these are conversations that help people buy and get into the property market time and time again. So there's a series of experience in there and there's a series of expertise in the book as well. I feel like I had a burning desire not to be an author, but to try and help more people.
Yeah, I love it, mate. I love the title. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, it's actually, we went on a trip to Japan and there's a book called Happy Money. And I was like, this is an interesting concept. Read the book on a flight to Japan. And you and I often deal in the world of, you know, there's good debt and bad debt. And I'm like, there's just debt in general that we've just been conditioned to think that one debt's better than the other. And people often think when I speak to them, oh, I'll just get investment debt because owner-occupied debt is bad debt. I'm like, it's the best debt you could ever have. If you need somewhere to live, you've got to rent or you've got to buy your own home. And I really just want to flip it on its head going, rent isn't dead money. Investment debt isn't necessarily good money or good debt. Debt is debt. But don't despise having a mortgage. In fact, having a mortgage is a privilege. And that is a real mindset shift because we see it like a ball in a chain. To be able to approve to buy a home and get a loan in this country is a wonderful achievement. We should be happy about it.
Yeah, I love that. And the, you know, the word that not good money or bad money, good debt, bad debt, but happy money in terms of what it enables you to do and the experiences and the family that you can bring up as a result of having a happy home. I think you've captured that beautifully. And immediately you write in the title, dispelled some of the fear that's often attached to the exercise. So we're going to sort of dive into a lot more of the detail shortly, but if you can sum up some of the key messages of the book and who's it best suited for, what would you say?
Yeah, the book is suited for people that are either buying their first property or looking to upgrade, because when they bought their first home, the market has changed significantly. And now they've got a property. What do they do with that property? Do they sell it? Do they turn it into an investment? So it kind of touches on that a little bit. So it's for really people that are early in their journey going, how do I break into the Australian market, the property market? And then given that the game's changed and it will continue to change as well, how do you stay one step ahead of the curve?
Yeah, and I've summed that up beautifully. Again, it's a bit of a scene setting here. I mentioned the old Australian housing affordability debate in the intro. What's your read on all that?
Yeah, as part of this, I did some research and there's a lot of research that comes out, but I picked it out into, is the Australian market, is it unaffordable? Is it unachievable? Is it unattainable? Or is it underquoted? And I'm going to say it's underquoted. And this comes out because I think a lot of people get despondent when they go start looking at properties. And here's a price range, for example. Price guide is 800 to 850. And then the property sells for 950. And they're like, I'm never going to be able to buy a property. This is ridiculous. And the sentiment just starts to build. And then the resentment starts to build that they're never going to get in. I'm like, that property was always going to sell for 950. It was just guiding 850 to get more people through the damn front door, right? So, and then I think that's where people get a little bit their nose out of joint. And then they're like, well, I'm never going to get in. And that's it. They throw their hands up in the air going, that's it. I'm never going to be able to buy. And they've cut their nose to spite their face by not getting in because someone else is going to buy that property with or without you. And so when I look at it, is it unaffordable? Certainly now the debt, like what it takes to service, I mean, the median house price across the country is about $1 million, thereabouts, over and above. So that means you need some pretty good incomes to be able to buy a property. Now, we're not all buying a freestanding home as our first home. So that kind of then dials it back to go, what can you afford to get in? Okay, great. So it actually isn't unaffordable. Where you're looking may be unaffordable. Is it unattainable? Absolutely not. There are so many Australians day in, day out, look at how many billions of dollars of loans approved each year. So it's not unattainable. There's so many people doing it. Is it unaffordable? Yeah, to some point, like the cash flow, okay, great. So does it mean we go down the rent vesting path? Does it mean we buy something cheaper and we use that as like a springboard or a stepping stone to buy the next property? Great, let's unpack the strategy a little bit. But I refuse to accept the fact that this property market is out of reach for the whole, like a whole generation.
Yeah, well, yeah, as I've said in the open, where there's a will, the way, and you actually got, the book gives some great ways of actually thinking about it a bit differently. Sort of transitioning from that, given the abundance of information that's available that we spoke about in part one, why do so many potential home buyers lack the confidence in their ability to buy property, do you think?
I think it's that it's a confidence game, and it's like a lot of parts in life. Like, why does not everyone start a business? Okay, there's a confidence element to it. Maybe it's not right for you. Maybe the timing's not right. Why are some people able to go traveling overseas and will land that perfect job? There's a confidence element to it. Will land that perfect partner. I think it just says a lot. It's probably an inner reflection on your greatest insecurities. It's a reflection on the peer group that you may have for the company you keep. It's a reflection of the mindset. It's a reflection of your product that you grew up in as well. Like your family for generations before you have only rented, and that's what you know, then it makes the odds aren't in your favor, like, because that's what you know, that no one has shown you home ownership.
Yeah, I'm going to jump straight in there because you give a great example in the book of the old fable about the eagle and the chicken. Can you sort of unpack that and relate that back to the relevance of buying a home?
Yeah, look, I can't take credit for this one. I'm pretty sure I heard this on a podcast. I can't remember which one though. But the story is there's a baby eagle that I think the egg falls down amongst the chicken eggs and it gets born in amongst all these chicks. And the farmer looks at it going, that's an eagle. Why can't it fly? And takes it out as it grows up, tries to get it to fly and be the majestic eagle. And it just wants to hang out with the other chickens. It's the company that it keeps. And then the farmer tries time and time again to get this eagle to see that it's a majestic beast and can fly, but it's just hanging out with the chickens. And I think the story keeps going on, and I can share that more of that fable in the show notes. Yeah. But when you talk about the essence and the message of it, the company that you keep, and there's so many studies around, the people that are in a circle, where that's the five people that you hang around most, will define who you are. It showed a lot to me about the people around you. If everyone around you is going, we can't get in, that misery loves company. And it's going, if that's the message that keeps getting pounded into you every Saturday over a coffee, for example, over beers on a Friday night, eventually you're going to believe it. Whereas if you're hanging out with people that are going, hey, I bought my second investment property. How did you do that? Tell me more. I spoke to this person. I spoke to this. The conversation just changes. And I feel like we always want to be around winners. Personally, I want to be around winners. Yeah. And when you're hanging around people that aren't winning, and that's the mindset that you're being fed, you're not hanging around with eagles. You're hanging around with chickens at that point.
Yeah, I love it. No, very well said. And I know we've talked a bit about the common fears that a lot of people have about buying a home. And you've also touched on in part one, the TEDx talk by Tim Ferriss,
yep,
about how to overcome those fears. Can you just unpack that a little bit? Because I think it's a really good approach that people can take on board immediately and not pick holes in those fears and give them the power and the strength to actually start taking some positive action.
Yeah, correct. And I think we said this before around how someone buy. It's like it's confidence. Okay, great. But what happens if someone's less confident than someone else? Okay, perfect. Let's go there. And Tim Ferriss did an awesome TED talk, which was around fear setting. So instead of like goal setting, some people go, something's going to get in the way. Okay, great. Well, let's write down what is going to get in the way. So let's do an example here. I'm renting. Okay, we still need to rent somewhere. So write down, well, I can't save for a deposit because I'm renting. I can't afford where I'm going to buy or where I want to live. Okay, can we think about rent vesting? Interest rates are going to go up. okay, can we think about a fixed rate? The property's going to need a lot of cash for maintenance if I buy it. Okay, great. Can we have a buffer for cash that goes into a maintenance fund? I won't be able to travel because I'm stuck with this mortgage. Okay, awesome. Can we have a little travel buffer? Or do we need to buy just a little bit less that gives you more cash to travel with? And so when you start to unpack these fears for people and you go, okay, I hear it. These aren't exclusive to you because every homeowner that I've spoken to has some degree of these fears simmer. But then they've been able to address it to go and buy their home. Okay, great. So what are these fears? And if we just can find a way to tease it out, because everyone is like, just go and buy. And when we use the word just, I feel like it diminishes the journey, just going, oh, it's so easy. And you know, like, all these books are like simple ways and easy ways. And I'm like, if it was that easy, everyone would be doing it. But they're not doing it. So we have to find a way to play in these gray areas that there are some people that are on the journey that aren't there yet. How do we just help them nudge forward one step at a time? And I feel like if we can just take the fears out of their head, so they can get out of their own way a little bit more and start to realize that there are ways to address each fear that they have, and that they're not being silly, that they're being quite rational about it, and this is a very logical step to take. If that enables home ownership, no bank is going to do that, right? That's our responsibility.
I love it. And that's a great transition into the next question I want to dive into, because as you and I know, it's generally the start that stops most people when it comes to property. So talk us through the best ways that you've unpacked in the book to save for a deposit.
There are a few ways. One is there's no shortcut. You're going to have to sacrifice something. And it sounds unpopular to start with, but I can't sugarcoat it. There's got to be some level of sacrifice. Paying yourself first is the great way. So, you know, you get your pay, the government gets paid first, and we live off the rest. And generally what happens is we have our expenses and then we save what's left over. Now, if you and I were running our business like that, we'd run it into the ground pretty quickly. Like, cash flow is the lifeblood of any business. And if you see your household as a business, you do the same. So your income comes in, the government gets paid. I need to save a bit and then I live off the rest. And that's your expenses. So that then if we start to unpack what's going on in the expenses side, what is absolutely critical and what is lifestyle and what is discretionary, and how do we siphon out what we absolutely need versus what are we going just to eliminate for a little while, make some sacrifices for the greater good of buying our own home. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's delayed gratification. That means, you know, when Bernie and I were trying to say there wasn't an overseas holiday, but there were shorter, smaller, more casual breaks and we still got to go away. So we didn't feel like we were like giving up every luxury. We stopped coffees for a bit. And I think that the $5 a day wasn't going to change our lives, but it was the discipline to go, hey, look, we can give up something.
Yeah.
The smash avo isn't going to change your life. You can do all the studies. 20 years of smash avocados to save a deposit. That's cool. All it is there's a mindset around, I'm going to give up things for the greater good. And if I can give up this, then I can give up that. If I can give up that, then I can give up this. It means that we don't take on the loan for the car. We buy cars in cash. It means we don't have a credit card, which means we're not spending money that we don't have. It means we're not doing afterpay. It means that I'm going to talk about, is the hex good for my borrowing capacity or not? Can I find a way to pay that out, for example, as well? Just by being curious about it or asking questions, we're going to get better answers. And that's really what is kind of leading into this. Can we move in with parents just for a short period? Can we find a way to get cheaper rent or ask for a discount on rent? It's very hard now because there is a rental crisis. But these are just small short-term maybe pain that we have to go through. But once you're in that house, that property, that unit, whatever it looks like, you will thank yourself for making those small sacrifices.
100%. And I love the fact that you've emphasized that the mindset that's inculcated with the happy habits and the daily disciplines that you start, because it's those habits that might start small, but if you do them regularly enough, they build that persistence and resilience to undergo the delayed satisfaction, so that when you actually do buy the home, the sense of achievement that comes out of that, second to none. So Love the way you talk that through. Now, another area that's close to both of our hearts and is often misunderstood when it comes to borrowing money is understanding borrowing capacity. Can you talk us through some of the nuances associated with this across the lenders and different situations that listeners need to be aware of?
Yeah, I mean, it's like that ad, same income, it's the same super, different results. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, the pair, that's the one.
Yeah. Butchered it. But it's the same thing, same income, 20 different, 30 different banks, different results. And you can't explain that to people because they're like, that seems like that's, I don't know, you're like a snake oil salesperson, you know, like that doesn't seem right. Banks will just look at it, it's all the same. It's like, no, there's nuances in how banks come up with borrowing capacity. So again, education piece, someone can't automatically know that because that's years of training for you and I and our teams. So be able to explain that to people, okay, there's differences in borrowing capacity. Okay, the killers that we see for borrowing, so I'll talk about the killers and what makes or break. So the killers generally are credit cards. People don't know that credit cards can impact your borrowing capacity. It's an innocent mistake.
Yeah.
And then we've got things like HEX as well. HEX, and especially young Australians have a HEX balance. We want people to study and get educated that you come up with a HEX balance, so it impacts your credit borrowing capacity. It's a double-edged sword, so is there an option to pay that out?
Yeah.
Case-by-case basis. Yeah. Personal loans, car loans, killers on borrowing capacity as well. What can really drive that up? You get bonuses, commissions, allowances, overtimes, whatever way that we can kind of scrape together more income. Now, some people inevitably go and get a second role, maybe pick up some casual work. I applaud it, but just know that that could be bank by bank dependent, 3, sometimes 6 months casual. So again, you have to grind that out to then be able to use that secondary income as well. The borrowing capacity side is an interesting one. And I think I might have touched it in our last episode, which is a lot of people buy below their borrowing capacity because they don't want to, inverted commas, stretch themselves. My suggestion here is stretch yourself to where you can just get a little bit of discomfort. A mortgage is for savings. So we talked about you get paid, the government gets paid, the bank gets paid next on our mortgage and we live off the rest. And if we didn't have that mortgage, we'd find probably a way to spend it because we're not saving it. So think of it a little bit like forced savings, as much as it may go against the grain. I'm not advocating for borrowing irresponsibly. I'm actually saying the bank will allow you to borrow it. So if the bank says yes, then take it. They're letting you borrow that money to go and buy an asset. The asset will have growth on the upside as well.
Totally. And the most expensive it's going to be is right here, right now, with inflation, increases in wages and changes in situations. What might feel above and challenging you right now won't in years to come. I know myself when my good wife Sonia and I bought our first place when we had virtually nothing to rub together. We bought a place for $84,000, would you believe, back in the 90s, and that was stretching us because we were coming from ground zero. And I borrowed 97% of that when you could back in those days. So that felt very challenging to us at the time. If I look back on it now, because of what's happened with property values and incomes and everything else, that loan was nothing in the scheme of things. And I think the other thing that is worth sort of reinforcing with what you've just shared with us there also is that, that old adage, and it might be showing my age now, Aaron, but that old adage, oils ain't oils. Well, I apply that to banks. Banks aren't just banks. They're not all the same. So there's 40 odd lenders. There's 2,000 different loan solutions or more out there. And not only are they all different in terms of how they interpret your borrowing capacity, but the other thing that I think, and again, you've probably seen this as well, a lot of would-be borrowers don't realize that it's not set in stone. What are banks prepared to do today? It might be very different to what they're prepared to do next week because the lending policies are constantly changing. Because they're massaging things based on the volumes that they want to write because they're a business just like everyone else. So when you go for a line at a point in time, and if someone says no, well, that's just one of many, But it also doesn't mean that now is no forever. It may well change in times going through. And that's where working with someone like Atelier Wealth other brokers have that knowledge and can therefore come up with a plan that's going to steer you in the direction that's going to help you to get the result when it's most needed. So I love that. One of the other subjects that I hear a lot about, I'm sure you do as well, and again, there's a great discussion with this in the book, is the good old lender's mortgage insurance. And I love where you pose the question, is lender's mortgage insurance or LMI a friend or foe? I'd love your thoughts on that and how you can actually use LMI to your advantage, which is something that I've personally done and I talked a lot of people about as well. So can you share with us your thoughts on that?
Definitely. I think there's one really polarizing part of getting a loan, which is a deposit. And again, people have great borrowing capacities, but because they're renting or whatever lifestyle, just can't, and by the time they save for a deposit, the property market just keeps growing and increasing. So the goalposts are constantly moving and it's chasing a deposit. Mortgage insurance effectively is the shortcut. And I'm so agnostic to banks or whoever it is that we're not trying to sell a product. We're trying to work on a solution here. And if the bank is giving you an opportunity to get into it by paying a small fee, I'm going, well, how long is it going to take you to save that deposit? And by that stage, property prices increase. And so you're buying less property in the future. I think LMI has certainly got a bad rap from some instances. Look, I love Scott Papes. I'm not calling him out by any means, but I've just said like that notion when he wrote the book to have a 20% deposit was certainly a admirable suggestion, but it's not a one size fits all approach, nor is my suggestion here. It's case by case dependent. And there's so many options, Bushy. Like we did one where we did LMI monthly. Like there's one, and you can pay LMI monthly. So like they didn't want the chunk of mortgage insurance. We knew that property was a growth asset. And within 6 months, we're like, switched it to another lender, 80% LVR. So in plain English, it means we'll ever switch the loan. It was back to an 80% loan to value ratio. And they didn't pay LMI anymore. And I was like, it was a small fee for a short period of time.
Absolutely. I see it as an enabler for the same reasons, because it's not... Yes, and again, LMI varies from lender to lender depending on who they're using or they're self-funding it. It's not a one-hit wonder as far as that goes. And the other key thing is if you capitalize it into the lending, then it's, as you just touched on, it works out to be a very small monthly commitment until such time as the property value is increased to a level where you can refinance and you don't need it anymore. So rather than keep chasing a train that's leaving the station, because the more you try to save, the higher the values go and you never quite get there to actually get on the ladder and then use the growth working for you rather than against you. I think LMI is a no-brainer. And for investors, it's a tax-deductible expense. So, if you've got a good account and you write it off in year one or over 5 years, so why wouldn't you be taking advantage of that and putting less of your money to secure a higher value asset? And if the growth's the same, you're going to end up with a better nest egg at the end of the day anyway. So,
you just said that you bought your property at 97%, right? Back then, there was no living expenses check. There was no factoring credit cards. Like, I look back when I started, 10 years ago, it looked like you were a cowboy back then compared to now. I'm like, it was loose. Like, the policies didn't add in living expenses or rental property expenses or private health insurance now. So we can only think it's only going to get harder in time.
Yeah.
So right here, right now is the best time to get a loan.
Yeah.
It's just going to get harder with the rise of tech and be able to like look inside bank statements and see how much you actually pay for living expenses. The tech is only going to get better and better.
Yeah.
And so when we're talking to people, it's like, this is, if you can get in, you can cop some mortgage insurance. Awesome. I'm surprised the amount of people that don't know they're eligible for no mortgage insurance. Like the amount of people I meet inside a bank, bank employees, medical professionals, lawyers, you name it, accountants. And they're like, I didn't know this.
Yeah.
This is why if we can have this conversation elevated a little bit more to go, don't fear it. embrace it, and actually some people don't even pay it. Oh my goodness, like what an enabler.
Spot on. And talking to a savvy mortgage broker like yourself or the members of our team, they'll work that out very quickly rather than try and go it alone. And like you mentioned a couple of times, what you don't know is what you don't know. So beautifully said. I want to sort of pivot a little bit now, because again, you've got a great section in the book that talks about the good old bank of mum and dad. I'd love your thoughts on the pros, cons, and risks, really, of opportunities through that sector in relation to guarantor loans, gifts, and other ways that parents can help people get into home ownership.
Yeah. I've done a number of guarantor loans, and people and parents are like, I'll give them cash, and I write a letter that it's a non-repayable loan, and it's not. There's no riskier side than this. There's no riskier side than this.
Yeah.
You're better off going as a guarantor and using equity than giving cash. And I'm amazed how many parents just go, I'm just going to give them cash, but they've got to pay me back. But they're going to write a stat deck, and to a young couple, on what happens if that relationship breaks down and you've said it as a stat deck, that is a gift. Like, yeah, it perplexes me. And I think parents, and I applaud parents wanting to help their kids. Like, that's 100%. Let's put that on the table here and say, well, it's a noble gesture, and to be able to have the benefit of parents being able to give you a leg up is such an advantage. So let's say that it's making sure that it's done right is where I feel like that's the conversation that needs to be had. You want to help your kids? Well, let's do it in the right, let's do it in the right way.
Yes, boom. Yeah, and again, a conversation with a savvy mortgage broker to understand the whys and wherefores of each of the options, so they're again making a better informed decision and minimizing and protecting themselves and their kids. It's really key in that. Sort of leveraging on from there, again, you give a great breakdown of the 5 C's of lending in the book. And I'd love for you to briefly talk about that. But as an extension to that, what are the key lending policies that borrowers really need to be aware of when they're fronting up to trying to get a home loan?
Yeah, look, I mean, the 5 C's is something you do is like, you call it 101 when you're becoming a broker. And so you're looking at the credit worthiness, and this means nothing to a borrower. It means a lot to a banker, to a broker. Their capacity to repay, you know, their credit history, for example, character. So is this person, no one in their loan notes is writing, this person has good character. What we're really telling a bank is they've been in employment. It's effectively stable employment. The bank can see that because you've been there for 2 years, for example. Compared to a contractor or a casual that keeps jumping around, like that's what the bank is effectively looking at, if we just want to call it out. You've been paying your rent on time. Like, we're just trying to build, because the thing is, this application, this static application is going in front of a human being at a bank that has no idea about your story. Whereas you and I have spoken to a client for hours getting to know their story, which is where the level of detail comes in our loan notes. And I explained this to a client, like, whoa. I said, yeah, the diligence that goes into putting this loan notes together, we're effectively telling the story to a bank. So why do some loans get declined? Is because unfortunately some peers just aren't putting the diligence and the detail into a loan application, because you and I probably got those on our desk going, that should never have been declined. It probably should never have gone to that bank in the first place.
Yeah,
that what happens when you know policy, and we'll get it approved, right? So this is the framework that a broker would follow in order to get a loan approved, is kind of what I've shown here, because this is our world and it's up to us to explain what goes on behind the scenes. Yeah, so that's what the 5 C's effectively covers off.
Yeah.
When it comes to lending policies, it's just making sure that that you know the banks and where their sweet spot is. So someone that's casual, okay, great. We look at lenders that have a sweet spot for casual employment. They've got a policy that enables it, or that's day one on the job. Like that, or she would surprise you and I, how many people go, I've got to wait 3 or 6 months before I start. I've got to show 3 months worth of payslips. I was like, no, you don't. First day on the job, give me a payslip. Let's rock and roll. And you say that, and they think you're a cowboy because that's something they've never heard before. And I'm like, no, that's what happens when you just know policy.
Yeah.
And one is, I think you and I probably have the master of the 10,000 hour rule. Like, we've got to a point that unconscious competence, like, we just can look at a loan and go, yeah, I know where that's going to go. I know how to structure that loan. Yeah. I've got newer brokers, and they're on that journey. What they don't know is what they don't know. So I'm helping them grow their expertise and their knowledge, but I'm not putting them in front of real life clients to practice on real life clients. They're shadowing me. They're going to learn. That's the only way, because I don't want them failing on real life clients. Whereas a lot of brokers, when you come out, they're like, okay, good luck. And we were like that at the start. And it's embarrassing what we didn't know at the start, right?
Exactly.
Like, people trusted us. I'm like, I don't trust myself at the moment, but I appreciate the vote of confidence.
It is that level of intuitive awareness you have, because you become a really important problem solver, because you understand the whole jigsaw. And when a piece comes across the table, you go, right, I know exactly where to put that piece. But for the average person lining up, thinking that banks are all the same, or brokers that have only been in the game for 5 minutes and enough to be dangerous, then that intimate awareness of what each bank will and won't do, where their flavor is, where their specialization is, what sort of business they're wanting to attract.
Yeah.
As you and I know, there's a whole myriad of stuff there that we can package it in such a way and de-risk the opportunity for the banks, which is really what all they're about. It's trying to minimize their own risk before they're prepared to give you the cash. Then there's some real merits in that. The other thing I'd love for you to sort of highlight, which you've done really well in the book as well, is the types of properties and or property conditions that many lenders don't like, because again, a lot of property buyers just aren't aware of those things. Can you sort of dive into that a bit for us?
Yeah. So when you've got clients that are buying purely on price, for example, I'll call on the Sydney example because it's probably relevant for younger buyers. Oh, look, I'll go and buy this really nice studio, and the studio is inadvertently under 50 square meters. Now, it's cheap for a reason, because not many banks can finance it. In fact, there's only a handful, literally a couple of banks that will do a property under 50 square meters. So when you're buying on price, that's what happens. You now need a 20% deposit, and you've only got a couple of banks you can go to. So if you're falling outside the scope of those two banks, then no go. And so that's what we're trying to get clients to, okay, zoom out a little bit. We've got a plan B, C, D, E, for example, with different lenders, just in case. And then we want to make sure that the property that you're buying, because banks are telling you, these are the sweet spots for properties. So avoid these ones, like high density units. Again, in Sydney, Melbourne, for example, parts of Brizzy, they're not blacklisting postcodes, but they're putting restrictions on that. And they're telling you, the banks don't particularly love that, because naturally there's not the growth in that asset. So they're signaling, when you're buying, and maybe not first-time buyers, but some upgrades when they're going to buy a coastal acreage. Beautiful property. I know you live in a beautiful part of Adelaide as well, but that's not a sweet spot for every bank. And so when you're buying over a certain land size, you might think that's a sweet deal, but the bank's going, that's a risk to us, because a bank will always look through the lens of, if we're to seize this property tomorrow and sell it, could we sell it easily? Which is where a 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom house in a suburban area is just a sweet spot, because someone will snap that up tomorrow. Whereas a 1-bedroom, 1-bath, 1-car in a high rise inner city building, there's just less buyers of that, and it has less growth inadvertently as well. So they're just a couple of examples, and the book will talk through more of that. But I always say, like, buying too close to train lines or transmission lines. Innocent mistake, but could actually be the reason that the bank says no.
Absolutely. And again, because you've dealt with that all the time, you're aware of that before even it gets raised as an issue. So that's talking to your broker before you start looking at property, as you, again, reinforcing the book's a really important step, because they'll guide you in terms of what to buy, where to buy, and then right down to price points. And a couple of other things that I think are closely associated with that, and again, chat for young players in the game, is that, over the years, there's been occasions where first-time buyers are looking to build a home, We'll go into an area where there's a lot of building going on. And for those that don't realise, if one bank feels like they've got too much concentration in that area, they won't lend. They might have lent to a heap of other borrowers, but they won't lend to you because they don't want to concentrate their risk. So again, a good broker will be aware of that and then would place that loan with someone else who doesn't have that level of exposure in that particular location. And then one of the other common things that we both see, I'm sure, is where, you know, we'll get a valuation of a property that doesn't come in where the owner or the buyer was expecting it to be. Because valuers are just like you and I, everyone's different, and they again have different risk appetites at different times, and depends on what the briefing has been from the actual particular bank at that point in time. Then rather than say, oh, well, that's a bit, the valuation's fallen through, having a good broker working with you will replace that with someone else who's going to get a valuation where it needs to be. So again, a lot of moving parts, and I guess I think the underlying message that you really strengthened in the book is the need to be curious and to keep asking and not take a no as a no. A no is just a temporary exercise. We need to look somewhere else and do something. So
I think a lot of people get offended when a bank, you know, maybe causes an issue with their loan or like says no. I think people get really personally offended by that. It's almost like some deep-seated rejection. It's like, no, that it's like the matchmaking service that just wasn't the right fit for that bank. And I think that's part of our role, the emotional energy that comes from, what's the bank asking for all this information? And why is the bank going to say no? It's like, do they know who I am? I'm like, that's not the case at all. It's a square peg in a round hole for this scenario versus we're trying to find a square peg, square hole, and it's going to be the right fit as well.
Yeah, beautifully said, mate. But moving on from there, so the last part of the book, I think, is also very valuable once you've actually purchased a home. Can you share with us some of your key pointers and philosophies on getting on with enjoying your life after you've actually secured the dream home?
Yeah, I think it can be so consuming, which is the loan process and then buying the home. There's so much data research that, and the book talks about how much research goes on. People think it's the most stressful part of their life.
Yeah.
And it's sad because it should be a celebrated achievement and milestone, but it's wrought with stress and anxiety, right? It puts your relationship through the paces when you're trying to buy something as well. So to come out of that, you probably got a little bit of PTSD from buying as well. But then there's some traps that happen straight afterwards. And I know this because I worked inside a big bank that statistically 60% of people go and buy a brand new car within the next few months of buying a home, which is the banks then cross-sell a loan for a car. So upgrade your home, upgrade your lifestyle. Because typically when you move, you bought something. There's something that's aspirational. So I say that, you know, the bottle of wine gets better at dinner. The restaurants get better because you've upgraded your life, right? So naturally everything keeps up. The furniture, you know, that IKEA furniture doesn't belong in this new house. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. All I'm saying is, just be conscious of it. Yeah. Nothing wrong with getting a new car, but going and spending $80,000 when you've got this new debt, for example, can we do with a $50,000 car? Like, can we just keep the ego in check there? That's one. Again, renovations, the temptation is to get in there straight away and renovate it. I'm like, look, just understand how the home works, because you may renovate it, but you may create another problem yourself that the house isn't livable or the floor plan needs a bit of work. So slow down to speed up is another thing there. And the other part is just be able to enjoy your life and the satisfaction and the enjoyment that comes with it. Celebrate it, enjoy it, take it easy. And then, you know, then we can talk about the renovations. Then we can talk about the future plans as well. But I think, yeah, just being able to be in that moment, I think is not talked about enough either.
I agree. Always on celebrate what you've done and enjoy it, and beware of the Diderot effect. So we're not going to explain what that is. I'm just going to put that out as a book there for people to read the book and find out what that is, because you give a really good definition of that. And it's been a really good talk through it, and really highlighted some of the things that most people just aren't aware of in the whole lending and home buying space. I really do recommend people, particularly. If a lot of listeners have got children who are, or close friends and family are looking to get into home ownership, it's a great primer to really give them the key things that they need to be thinking about, how to get mentally prepared, who to associate with them, and that some of the intricacies involved in the whole lending process that will really wake them up, and particularly when they're getting the help of a good broker. So really appreciate it. Mate, I want to jump now into part two of the Bushfire Lightning Round, where I hit you with the fast four questions. First of those, Aaron, is what's your favourite quote and why? And you've got some great quotes in the book, but what's your favourite and why is it?
I'd say whether you think you can or you can't, you're right. I mean, it goes for a lot of that's the analogy of life for me.
Yeah, absolutely spot on. Apart from your own book, what's the top book that you'd recommend we read and why?
This is a close tie. I'm going to break the rules and say, can I put two in here? Apart from your books, Bushy, I've just finished reading The Psychology of Money.
Yeah, it's a cracker.
I'm like, that is the blueprint. That is the blueprint for me. I'm like, I wish someone gave it to me earlier because there's been some awesome books in the past, but I'm like, this just, the short chapters, explains it, written so well. I love that. And then I'd say Atomic Habits.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Close second. Yeah. So if we just put in the context of home buying, if you think like a renter or you think like a homeowner, you're going to have two different outlooks on life. So while you're renting, you go, I'm going to be a homeowner and I'm going to act like one versus I'm stuck being a renter and you have a renter mindset. You just see your habits will change. Like we talked about, like making sacrifices. I'm a homeowner. I'm going to make the sacrifice. I'm not going to go on that holiday. Versus I'm a renter, I demand to get into the property market. Well, you're not making any sacrifices.
Yeah, yeah. Beautifully said, mate. So we've talked a lot about habits during both episodes. And to bring that to a head, what's a personal happy habit, rewarding ritual or daily discipline that you employ that you think's contributed most to your success?
Well, for me, it's the gym. Like, it's my version of meditation. You know, I live in a surfing community, but I'm probably one of the only blokes that doesn't surf. I do like to go to the gym in the morning. It's just my time. No kids, no phone, my time just to be in my own world. And I get enjoyment out of that. And for me, that then shows up because then I eat healthier, then I sleep better. I'm just making better decisions throughout the day as well.
Yeah, 100% agree with you there. And for guys like you and I, it burns out the frustration. So we're much happier human than time with as well, in my experience. To sort of summarise our great conversations across both episodes, what are your key takeaways for those listening in?
I'd say buying is a mindset. There's buying a mindset and investing in yourself. So if someone's listening to this people are listening to this podcast, you're investing in yourself, and then you're finding people around you that are raising that frequency that help you on this journey. Bushy, what you're doing here, there's no commercial benefit. You go, I just want to help people get better.
Yeah.
And that comes from a place of purity. Same with the book. There's no royalties that are going to change my life off this book. But if this book can help more people get into the market and changes their lives, I've achieved a mission in my life. Like, I've helped more people buy property. It's going to change their bloodlines, generate their wealth position. That's a small price for me to going away and writing this book and then getting it published. So, yeah, that's kind of where I'd leave it.
Beautifully said. To sort of close it out, if I ask you to get invested, what does that mean to you?
The word get means take action. So whatever your modality is in investing, whether it's shares or crypto or real estate, whatever it is, get means you're taking action and you're going to be the beneficiary of that in the future.
Beautifully said, mate. For those that really piqued their interest, where can they get a copy of the Happy Home Loan? The Happy Home Loan Handbook.
It's a mouthful. So there's the Happy Home Loan Handbook website. Jump on there. You can order through there. But for anyone that's listening, I've got copies to give away. So find me on LinkedIn, find me on socials. Our contact details will be in the show notes. So drop me an email if you want a copy. I just want to give the knowledge away to people that are engaged and want to better themselves. From me to your listeners, that's a very small gift, but I hope it goes the distance.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I like people to actually take some action and challenge them to take some action to earn a copy of the book rather than give it away, because as you and I both know, if you've made some effort, then you're going to respect this old law. So how about, I'm just going to make a suggestion here, that we award a copy of the book to the best email response to hello@knowhowproperty.com.au. I want you to answer the following question. What's the best thing that you've learned from our discussion on the Happy Home Loan Handbook? So we'll shoot it through. Aaron will judge those and then shoot out as many copies of the book as he's comfortable doing to actually help you on your ongoing journey, or your kids, family and friends, for those that can really benefit from it. So look, mate, really want to thank you again for sharing all of your wealth and wisdom and the ins and outs of your great book. Again, for those that are listening in, if you want to keep the conversation going, jump onto the Property Hub Collective Interactive Facebook community by clicking the link in the show notes, where you can actually share your questions and comments with other like-minded, hardworking Aussies. And I really want to thank you again, Aaron. For those who want to tune into you and Atelier Wealth, where can they do that?
Yeah, check out our socials. Like you, got our podcast. We get great guests. And then we'll put our content on our YouTube as well. So you'll find us, Instagram. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn as well. So connect. And like I said, these connections will lead you to the next person, will lead you to the next person. If you can just raise that bar around your advisors and that network around you, we want to get better. We want to take people on that journey. So yeah, love to be connected as well. Thank you very much, Bush.
Love it, mate. Let's keep the conversation going. Thanks, Aaron.
Yep. Good on you.
Thanks for tuning in to Get Invested on the Property Hub podcast channel, your home for property investment insights and inspiration. And don't leave yet until you've taken the next step towards living by design. By getting my award-winning book, Get Invested, absolutely free when you sign up at knowhowproperty.com.au or bushymartin.com.au. And finally, make sure you subscribe to Property Hub to get your weekly dose of Get Invested inspiration, along with every episode of Realty Talk, Australia's leading property show for red-hot property investing news and insights, direct from industry leaders and influencers. Remember to always get invested in your knowledge, and I look forward to seeing you next time.